Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today. It's been another historic week for workers around the world who have either lost their job because of the COVID-19 pandemic or who are risking their lives trying to protect us from the deadly virus. On this week's show, Kurt Stand, who at least until recently was a bookseller at Busboys and Poets here in Washington, D.C., tells us about his last days at work.
With a sense of foreboding, loud, boisterous crowds drank away at the bar one evening. The next, according to the rules, no bar service. Finally, the announcement. The governor declared all restaurants closed.
And though Bernie Sanders' bid for the presidency looks likely to fall short again this year, Carl Goldman reminds us of the day in 1913 when 20,000 striking textile workers and their supporters gathered in front of the house of the socialist mayor of Haldion, New Jersey.
Before World War I, the Socialist Party had 2 members of Congress, over 70 mayors and many state legislators and city council members.
Jessica Pawczyk wraps up this week's show with the story of Tough Annie, a woman of means who threw in her lot with working women in London during the struggle for women's suffrage.
I'd never had to go out to work as we'd been comfortably off. Then one day something happened, which really woke me up.
Here's the show. Until recently, Kurt Stand was a bookseller at Busboys and Poets here in Washington, D.C. He and I have worked together for years on the monthly Bread and Roses Labor Culture series at Busboys. In Fear at Work, published on the Stansbury Forum, Kurt talks about his last days at work.
Worry slowly mounted over the past few weeks. But worry about what? I work at a bookstore that is part of a restaurant and event space. Since the new year, there has been, like the spread of coronavirus itself, growing concern about the disease, slight at first, then becoming deeper and more profound. For some, the danger seemed exaggerated. For others, danger signs were seen everywhere. By contrast, simultaneously, a fear spread shared equally by all my coworkers. Fear of loss of income, loss of job. That economic insecurity, more palpable, more familiar, easier to grasp and discuss, joined the nameless fear of illness. Taken together, we have lived a life of nervous anxiety. All this contributed to an odd sensibility about customers, those coming in for a meal, to attend an event, to buy a book. After all, unlike a grocery store or pharmacy, no one has to go to a restaurant, and so we wondered why folks might risk their health going out to eat. Yes, of course, we all wanted them to come, because if they didn't, our jobs would be gone. Initially, despite the looming threat, people came. Then overnight there was a drop-off. Events were hit first, with attendance down, and then canceled. As news reports announced the virus arrival in the vicinity, numbers eating out fell more. And with that, so too did book purchases. Some bought in case they should have time on their hands. Others said, quite sensibly, now might be the time to read books that for too long have been sitting on a shelf at home. Servers reliant on tips were most impacted. Each day, more staff had shorter hours. Each day, there was the hope people wouldn't be sensible. They would come in, mixed with the fear that someone infectious might enter and infect us too. Both the reality and what we thought about that reality became unsustainable as the news worsened hour by hour. New rules were set. Groups seated at a table had to be of 6 or less. Booths and tables where diners sat had to be separated by an empty one. People should not sit or stand at the bar. All rules that proved hard to enforce. What do you say to 2 couples with 3 children who come in for a meal? With a sense of foreboding, loud, boisterous crowds drank away at the bar one evening. The next, according to the rules, no bar service. Finally, the announcement. The governor declared all restaurants closed until the public health crisis. The last day, our regulars who come by themselves, either to work with a cup of coffee or to have breakfast alone but not alone, all showed. Then the curtain closed. The governor's decision was the correct one, no doubt. Public health is another way of describing taking care of each other. But it is not an easy road. While it is true no one has to eat out, it is also true that a shared meal outside of one's home has an intrinsic value that can't be easily measured. So, too, does browsing through a bookstore before making a purchase. The loss of such, when added to all the other closures involved in a quarantine, is real. It is a loss those of us who worked at this restaurant share in our own private lives. I began by writing that I work at a bookstore. I now have to add an ED to that word. At the stroke of a pen, we were unemployed. For some, the loss is harder than others. One co-worker was laid off from another job. Her husband's hours were cut on a job that won't last much longer either. I wished her luck as she left with her child, blithely unaware of what's going on because of the brave, friendly face she wore. I have my own challenges, as do we all living within that palpable, familiar territory of unemployment, of income loss, and just the sense of loss. And meanwhile, the nameless worry about her health, the health of her family, friends, neighbors remain, as does the unanswered question, what will we do about it?
Kurt Stand, a bookseller at Busboys and Poets here in Washington, D.C., reading Fear at Work, published on the Stansberry Forum, stansberryforum.com, where you'll find lots more great writing on labor, politics, immigration, the environment, and world affairs. Bernie Sanders' bid for the presidency looks likely to fall short again this year, but Carl Goldman reminds us of the day in 1913 when 20,000 striking textile workers and their supporters gathered in front of the house of the socialist mayor of Haldion, New Jersey.
Hi, this is Carl Goldman calling from Silver Spring, Maryland. On April 3, 1913, 20,000 textile mill strikers in Paterson, New Jersey, gather on the green in front of the house of Pietro Botta, the socialist mayor of nearby Haldion, to receive encouragement by novelist Upton Sinclair, journalist John Reed, and speakers from the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies. Today, the Bottle House is home to the American Labor Museum. At its height before World War I, the Socialist Party had two members of Congress, over 70 mayors and many state legislators and city council members. The Socialist Party was the precursor to the present-day Democratic Socialists of America, which has over 100 elected officials, including two members of Congress. DSA continues its Socialist Party tradition through its support of and direct involvement in the struggles of working people.
Carl Goldman, longtime organizer and former executive director of AFSCME Council 26. Jessica Pozak wraps up this week's show with the story of Tough Annie, a woman of means who threw in her lot with working women in London during the struggle for women's suffrage.
Hi, everybody. I want to share some women's history from the Federation of Worker Writers and Community Publishers collection. Throughout the FWWCP's history, women were involved in every part of the network, including as founding members in 1976, as the co-editors of an all-women's anthology called Move Over Adam, and of course as members of individual writing groups, many of whom published life stories documenting the many roles that working class women had. Today I want to talk about the history of one particular woman, named Annie Barnes, who, in conversations with Kate Harding and Caroline Gibbs, published her story entitled Tough Annie, From Suffragette to Stepney Counselor. This book was published by Stepney Books Publications in 1980 and sold for just £1.50. Throughout this booklet, Annie Barnes, who was born in 1887, describes her upbringing in the East End of London and how she grew up with some money during this time. She explains how she learned from her mother that everyone, despite money, should be treated as equals, and how her life was shaped when she heard about a group called the Suffragettes. In England during the early 1900s, women who fought for the right to vote were called suffragettes. For those interested, there's a really good movie called Suffragette, made in 2015 with Carey Mulligan and Meryl Streep. In any case, Annie describes the very moment she learned about the suffragettes and Mrs. Pankhurst's work fighting for women in 1905. She states, "I'd been very quietly brought up. I'd never had to go out to work, as we'd been comfortably off. Then one day something happened, which really woke me up. I'd been shopping with my mother in Aldgate, and there's an open space just there where someone was holding a meeting. But on this occasion, there were four women on a car speaking. That was unusual, to see women speaking. 'We want to do away with the sweatshops and all these terrible things that are happening,' they were saying. The speakers were fighting for us women to have the right to vote." This public discussion sparked Annie's interest, and it led her to later join the East London Federation of Suffragettes, started by Sylvia Pankhurst, who believed in a campaign for all women, not just rich women like her mother and sister had believed in. Annie describes her first mission as a suffragette, stating, "My very first mission was when I volunteered to go up the monument and throw leaflets saying 'Votes for Women' off the top. We couldn't give them out in the streets because the police were after us. So off I went to London Bridge with two carrier bags full of leaflets. Up and up the spiral staircase I went, and the bags were heavy. But I was young and strong, and on I went." Sylvia Pankhurst had said, "Be as quick as possible. Throw them over and get down quickly, because the police will be after you." That was my first job, mind you. Sylvia was such a wonderful woman. She only had to say something, and you wanted to do it. Barnes also describes how these moments impacted her in her later years, shaping her political beliefs, leading her to become a member of the Labour Party in 1919, a member of the Women's Cooperative Guild, and then even run for local election in 1934 as a councillor for the Borough of Stepney. In the final pages of the booklet, Barnes recounts London being bombed out in 1944, and how she was at home as the neighborhood was hit and her house was turned into debris. In each moment, Barnes details how her home life was impacted by the political community she became part of, beginning with the suffragettes. As she concludes her story, Barnes notes, "I've had an interesting life. It hasn't all been roses, but I enjoyed my work for the party and the council. I've met so many interesting people. I'm finished now. I haven't been to a labor meeting for years because of the arthritis. I've got a few things I could say to labor government. One thing I'd like to do is go to the House of Commons sometime. I'd get a seat furthest from the aisle so I'd have plenty of time to say what I wanted before they could drag me out." If you're interested in reading Tough Annie or publications like these, you can visit the FWWCP collection at fwwcp-dc.org. In particular, you could also check out our reading guides focused on gender and other topics. You can also check out our Instagram, which is fwwcp-collection. And whenever you find yourself in London next, we hope you'll visit the Trades Union Congress Library at London Metropolitan University to access these and other publications from the FWWCP collection. Avanti popolo, alla riscossa, bandiera rossa, bandiera rossa. Avanti popolo, alla riscossa, bandiera rossa, trionferà. Bandiera rossa, trionferà.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app, and as always, we hope that you do. Please pass it along. We appreciate it. Also, if you'd like to contribute by reading a labor history item, it's a lot easier than thinking. It's kind of fun. Shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Today's music included Bandiera Rossa, which is Italian for red flag. The song, often also called Avanti Popolo after its opening words, is one of the most famous songs of the Italian labor movement. So, we thought it appropriate in the spirit of global solidarity as our brothers and sisters in Italy struggle with one of the deadliest outbreaks of the COVID-19 virus. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the CalMedevitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe Daniel, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time. For socialism and liberty.